This parable of the rich fool is important, really, for a couple reasons I want to call attention to. The first reason is Jesus is speaking about a real person. He's not speaking about an angel. He's not speaking about, you know, wineskins, some tangible material thing. He's talking about a real person, a real human being. The second thing that I want to note about its importance is that he is a successful person. I think most of us here would agree that we love to hear rag to riches type of stories. We like to hear about someone that starts out and truly just comes through the ranks and literally makes themselves something through hard work, through sweat, and through labor. But what is so shocking about this particular story is what Jesus says about this man in verse 20. Look at verse 20. But God said to him, "You fool." That absolutely shocks us this morning. It even offends us because we think, how can a hero be a fool? That's a great question, isn't it? How can the hero of the story that everyone aspires to be a fool? That's really what the question. That's why this particular parable just arrests us. It grabs us. Because in our thinking, the hero is never a fool. You see, this story teaches us the failure of success. It's possible to be successful in the eyes of the world, but in God's eyes, be a failure and a fool. We can have literally all that the world has to offer and still miss the main ingredient. Can you imagine baking a cake without flour? That's a daunting task, isn't it? Well, that's, in a sense, what this man did. He was attempting to produce, he was attempting to build, he was attempting to find what life was all about, but at the end, he missed the key ingredient, which was the Lord himself. In Luke 16:15, Jesus says, "For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God." So it is very, very possible to, again, have the failure of success as a person. Now, we keep in mind that the section we're looking at began in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, and extends all the way to chapter 19, verse 27. Now, the heading of this section that we're going to look at this parable is the rejection of the Son of Man. Jesus has been rejected. He's heading towards Jerusalem. Jesus is in the upper Galilee area, and he's traveling approximately 95 to 100 miles south to Judea, to Jerusalem. And there in Jerusalem, Jesus will meet his purpose. It's the cross. So in this section, Jesus is having various encounters on the road to Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, Luke mentions 10 different times as he was traveling to Jerusalem, as Jesus was on the road. It says it 10 different times. So this section is more instruction than it is miraculous. The last section that dealt with the ministry of Jesus was more miraculous than it was instruction. So Luke now flips it or turns the table, and this section really deals with more instruction. And why? Because Jesus is preparing his disciples for the cross. He's teaching them about what they need to be as disciples. So this 12th chapter has as its theme, hindrances to holiness. Jesus is warning the disciples about things that will hinder them in becoming holy, having them resemble the Lord. So the first hindrance is in verses 1 through 12, and we looked at this last week, and it's be careful lest Satan hinder you. That is the fear of man. Satan loves to use fear to sidetrack us. So we talked about being hypocritical, being fearful of man. But now in verses 13 to verse 34, be confident God will not fail you. This now is a warning regarding the love of money. are being covetous, and how many people are led astray because of their love of money, their love of some object. So we're going to spend 2 weeks looking at that, this week and next week. And then lastly, in verses 35 to 59, be consistent in preparing for Christ's return. We need to be ever thinking of the Lord's return is what we're going to be talking about. So here's how I want to break it down this morning. In verses 13 through 15 is the setting. It's the setting of this parable. And then in verses 16 to 20 is the story. And then in verse 21 is the supposition. It's the meaning of the story. So I'm going to kind of reverse this. Let me give you the thought of what this says this morning. What's the thought when you take verses 13 through 21 and you boil them down to their very essence? What is it saying? Well, believers trust God to meet needs, thus being liberated to serve God with single-mindedness. You see, as a believer, our faith and trust is in God who will can sustain us, who will provide for us. So we're not caught up in all the things of the world. We're not anticipating stockpiling this and getting this, getting that, because we're freed from all of that so that we can serve God. We're not controlled by those things. That's not where our heart is. That's not where our God is. That's not where it is. So let's pick it up here now in verses 13 through 15, and let's talk about this setting. Now again, Saturday night, Sunday morning, ccrealta.com. You got the app right now. You go to this week, you open the app, and then you go to Sunday, and you click on Sunday, and then 4 pages of notes will be there on your screen. We're going to put 4 pages of notes up on the screen right now, and you'll be able to follow along. I think printing them out and putting them in a binder, bringing your Bible, bringing a pen, you know, and as God speaks to you, and he will, because when the Bible speaks, God will speak, we can jot down what God is revealing to us, little areas that the Spirit of God will pinpoint. So let's look at this setting beginning in verse 13. It says, and someone in the crowd said to him. Now, the context of this is that Jesus has had a luncheon, and in this luncheon, it got extremely heated. Jesus was invited by a Pharisee to have brunch or lunch. And so when Jesus got there, he didn't ceremonially wash his hands like the Pharisees did. They believed that when you went into the marketplace, you got demons on your hands, so you had to wash the demons off. And they had all these weird little teachings that they concluded was equal with Scripture, and they weren't even in the Bible. So Jesus wasn't going to submit to this nonsense. He was going to follow the Scriptures, not their wishes of the Scripture. So they start attacking Jesus for not washing his hands. So Jesus then resorts to exposing them, and he says, you're hypocrites. Every single one of you is hypocrites. Can you imagine being invited to someone's house and calling them a hypocrite 6 times? I mean, that's what Jesus did. He's my hero. He really is. I mean, he doesn't mix any words. He just came right out and said. So when Jesus left the house, it was heated. They decided that we're going to find some dirt on Jesus. We're going to have to deal with Jesus. He can't continue to exist, and we can't live with him, and we're going to live without him, and so we're going to get rid of him. And so in chapter 12, verse 1, we read, and under these circumstances, after so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So Jesus now launches into chapter 12, and I believe that the entire chapter took place at one sitting. So this is a long discourse. It's a chapter long, and I believe it is one setting because there are 2 interruptions that take place in this discourse. We're going to look at the first one now in verse 13. This is where an individual interrupts Jesus about a family inheritance in which he wants Jesus to step in and settle it. And then the other one is in verse 41. It is interesting to note that some of Christ's greatest teachings were the result of interruptions. Isn't that interesting? That some of the greatest things that Jesus ever said were the result of being interrupted. Blessed interruptions, and this is one of those blessed interruptions in which it gives birth to this parable of the rich fool. So Jesus is now interrupted, and the person says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Now, you have to know a little bit about Jewish culture to understand what this man is saying. In Jewish culture, the eldest son was the one that received the inheritance, the just of the inheritance. And then the other members of the family, their inheritance was tied to the oldest brother who possessed the majority of the inheritance. So what was probably happening here, the oldest brother had received this family estate, maybe a farm, we don't know, a business. And so this younger brother would not be able to receive his inheritance unless his brother was willing to cash it out. But in many cases, the older brother wouldn't do it because if the farm's being productive, if everybody's making money in the family, why sell it? I mean, if this thing is growing and it's advancing, it would be kind of foolish to say, hey, let's sell this thing so that I can make my little brother happy by cashing out. So this is probably the scene before us that this individual is wanting his brother to sell it out. But I find it interesting the context of this interruption, what Jesus has been saying. If you go back to verse 8, here's the context of what Jesus just said. "And I say to you, everyone who confesses me before men, the Son of Man shall confess him also before the angels of God." So Jesus has been speaking about fearing God, not man, and confessing Jesus before men so that in turn God can confess us before the angels of heaven. Do you know this guy is not interested in that? What he's interested in is his money. He's interested in his inheritance. I feel sorry for this person. Here is Jesus Christ. Right in front of Jesus, this man is in front of the Son of God. He's in front of the Savior that's going to die for his sins. And here was the golden opportunity for this man to say, you know, you just said that if I confess you before men, you will confess me before my Father. How do I do that? What do I need to do that you'll confess me before your Father and the angels of heaven? What a golden, but guess what he talks about? He's concerned about his family inheritance. He's concerned about getting his money. Now, the man doesn't even state the condition, so we're just, in a sense, trying to figure out what he's doing. And through culture, that was how it was. So if he was wanting the inheritance and he's wanting to get it from his family, it's because his family isn't willing to sell it out so he can get his portion. But he doesn't tell us that his brother's ripping them off. He doesn't tell us that he's ripping them off. We really don't know any of that. He doesn't give us any of that details at all. What he's basically demanding is, Jesus, can you please take my side? Will you please tell my brother he's wrong and what I'm asking him to do is what he should do? That's what he's doing. And I tell you, as a pastor, I can't tell you how many times people have come in and they want me to side with them. I had someone just a while ago came in and they were talking about how wicked their wife was, and I was wondering if she had 666 on her forehead or something, you know, the way he was describing her. She sounded like the girl in The Exorcist with her head going around in circles, you know, and so he was describing how wicked his wife was and all this, and I just stopped and I said, wait a second. If you're trying to convince me that it's right for you to divorce your wife who is a believer, you're going to the wrong pastor. I'm like the most pro-marriage pastor in the world, and I love marriage. My wife might not have said the same thing, but I loved it. And so I again said, you need to find somebody else because I'm not your guy. If you want to come in and talk about your marriage, let's talk about how you can restore it. That's what I would like to do. I would love to do. Let's find out how we can fix this thing. Well, that's what this guy was coming to. He was coming to Jesus so that Jesus could side with him. Jesus could say, yeah, tell your brother I said that he needs to sell the farm and cash out and give you what's coming to you. Well, verse 14 says, but he said to him, man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you? Jesus isn't even going to take the case. Jesus opts out and says, why are you coming to me about this thing? I am not going to get in the middle of all this. Now, you think about it for just a moment. Could you imagine the decision Jesus would make? It would be perfect. He could probably end this thing in just less than a sentence. He could give a verdict. The verdict would be holy. It would be righteous. It would be God's will. He could literally do it in a matter of moments. But how sad that there was the Son of God right in front of this interrupter, and his focus is upon materialism. Notice the word that Jesus used. He used the word man. He says man. Now, this word man in the Greek means a stranger. So Jesus didn't know this person. This person was not known to Jesus. He had never met him before and had no interaction with him. And he says, who appointed me judge or arbiter over you? So he's basically saying, I'm not starting the people's court, is basically what he's saying. I'm not going to do that. Now, rabbis would do this. I mean, a rabbi, you could go to a rabbi with a civil issue, a family issue, and you could... parties could go before a rabbi and say, hey, here's our situation. What say you? What should we do? And a rabbi would basically stand in as a spiritual judge and would make a decision regarding that. But I think as Jesus is looking at this man, the context of him, you know, he's just talked about denying God before men and so forth, and he's talking about a relationship with God, and this man launches into wanting his inheritance. You see, there are many people that want Jesus to solve their problems, but they don't want Jesus to change their heart. They just don't. They want what God can do for them. Fix my marriage, fix my relationships, fix my financial hardships, but I don't want salvation. I just want you to fix my problems. So he's kind of like the lucky rabbit's foot. It is kind of interesting, the lucky rabbit's foot. It wasn't too lucky to the rabbit, was it? You know, it's like, it is kind of interesting. So Jesus is, you know, the little coin you keep in your pocket. He's the lucky rabbit. That I call on him when I need something, but I don't need salvation. I just need God to solve my problem, not change my heart. And I think that Jesus knew that this family feud was more over money, and it was really a symptom of a deeper problem, which was the problem of covetousness. I think Jesus, of course, being the wisdom of God, saw through all of this smoke and mirror, and he realized what I'm dealing with here is someone that is very covetous. This is someone who has another God before him. He is someone that thinks that pleasure is going to come through his amassing of wealth, and that's going to make his life complete, which it won't. And so Jesus is seeing all through this. I like what Leon Morris says. He says, Jesus came to bring men to God, not property to man. So that's not why he came. And so I feel sorry for this man. I really do. I don't know the man. I hope someday to watch this heavenly Blu-ray. But boy, this man is a big disappointment. This man has the Son of God right before him, and he asked him to work out a family squabble when in reality he could have received salvation and the forgiveness of his sins. I think of what Jesus, when he gave the parable of the seeds in Matthew 13:22, I think this parable applies to the man. Listen to these words. And the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. That's this man. This man's into money. He's into the world. And coming to God isn't on his agenda. It's not his priorities. It's Jesus helping him get as much of the world that he possibly can. So verse 15 says, then he said to them, beware and be on your guard. Now, notice a warning. Jesus now gives a warning. Notice the wording here. And he said to them. So what Jesus does now is he takes this interruption and he now uses it as a teaching time to instruct the crowds. He's speaking now to the crowd. No doubt he's speaking to his disciples, and this man is listening. So the man's the one that asked the question, but Jesus now responds to the crowd, and he's speaking to his disciples, and he's speaking to this man himself. And it's interesting to note that Jesus warns now about covetousness. You know what's interesting? When you read the gospel, Jesus never warned about adultery. He never warned about fornication. But he did warn about being covetous. Isn't that interesting? You know, because immorality is a big problem in our society today, and it destroys a lot of people's lives. You would think that Jesus would have warned many, many times about it. But the thing that he warned about was covetousness. Covetousness. It's a great warning. Notice he says, against every form of greed. The word greed could be translated covetous. It means the lust to have more than one's fair share, a boundless grasping after more, a craving for more of what you have enough of already. And by the way, covetousness is the opposite of contentment. A covetous person is a person that is not content. I love this. A mother was cutting up a cake to serve to her children and their guests. And the little boy, Brian, was looking at mom cutting up the cake. And he says, "Mom, I want the biggest piece." So mom looks down at Brian and says, "It's not polite to ask for the biggest piece." So Brian looks down at the ground. He says, "Well, then how do I get it?" What's the procedure to getting what I want? If I ask for it, shouldn't I have it? Isn't that the way that I could get it? Because that's what I want. So this man's coming to Jesus and he's asking. You look at Eve. Eve is the mother of sin. She brought sin into the world. She again disobeyed God. Why? Because she wanted to be like God. The result of that was death. Sin entered into the world. You got Lot's wife that coveted, looked back to Sodom, and turned into a pillar of salt. You got Achan, who kept back some of the spoils from Jericho, and it cost Israel many lives when they went up against the city of Ai. You got David that coveted his neighbor's wife, resulting in a reproach to Israel and God's judgment. You know, covetousness is the 10th commandment. It's in Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. Listen to these words. "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his SUV, or his high-definition big-screen TV, or surround sound, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." Notice he says anything. You know why? Because when you break the 10th commandment on covetousness, you break the other 9. You break the 10th commandment, and you are a violator of all 10. Think about it. If you commit adultery, what are you doing? You're coveting someone else's spouse. And you have another god before you. You have an idol before you. So you can see how breaking this 10th commandment just dominoes, and it just absolutely causes us to be a lawbreaker as to God's commandments. Proverbs really does a great job on saying that the great dividing line between a righteous man and an unrighteous man is covetousness. Listen to this, Proverbs 21:26. "All day long he is craving, while the righteous gives and does not hold back." Boy, what a contrast. Ephesians 5:3. "Do not let immorality or impurity or greed even be named among you, as is proper among saints." Listen to this, Colossians 3:5. "Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desires, and greed, which amounts to idolatry." Rockefeller, who was one of the richest men of his time, was once asked the question, "How much is enough?" And you know what he said? "Just a little more." That's what he said. See, that's the way covetous being coveted is and having greed. You're never satisfied. You always want more and more and more. And the deception is thinking that if I get more, I'll be satisfied. But you're not. You keep going and going and going. 1 Timothy 6:9 says, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." So Jesus says, "For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." The great error of a person is materialism. It's thinking that if I get this person, if I get this promotion, if I get this job, if I'm able to earn this much, all of life will be put together. All will be well. We think that an abundance of things is the key to a successful life. Jesus teaches the opposite in this parable, that an abundance of things can actually make you a failure. You get everything you want, it will result in being a failure, is what Jesus is saying here. Now, let's not limit this morning, when we talk about covetousness or greed, to money. We're not necessarily saying that. It could be clothes, it could be a position, it could be a home, it could be a relationship. I mean, we can go on and on. It can be a career. It's endless what we can have greed towards or what we desire or what we covet. So let's you know, though he is referring to a man over an inheritance that had an issue with selfishness and greed and hedonism and all this other stuff, let's not limit it to that. It's that greed, it's that covetous over this area. I like what Warren Wiersbe says. He says, "People say that money does not satisfy, but it does satisfy if you want to live on that level. People who are satisfied only with things that money can buy are in great danger of losing the things that money cannot buy." So it really can satisfy you if you're worldly and you don't care about eternity, you don't care about God. I mean, it really could, in one sense, satisfy you, but keep in mind, it's only temporal. So this brother thought that if he could have this inheritance, all of his problems would be solved. He could, as it says, live happily ever after. Now, by the way, God's not indifferent to our needs. Drop down to verse 29 and 30 of this same chapter of Luke 12. God is aware of what you and I need. Now, we're not talking about that. So verse 29, "And do not seek what you shall eat or what you shall drink, and do not keep worrying, for all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, but your Father knows that you need these things." And we'll get into that next week. So we're not to think that God doesn't care, because God does. God already knows what we need, and God's going to provide that so that our focus can be on other things. So this brings us now to verses 16 through 20, and this is the story. So he says here in verse 16, "And he told them." So again, who's them? It's the crowd. So Jesus now continues to address this story. He addressed a warning, now the story, to the crowd, his disciples, and to this man. And the Bible says, "A parable saying." Now, a parable, the word parable means to cast alongside of. A parable is an illustration that was always cast alongside of teaching or instruction. Jesus never told a story. Jesus never gave an illustration standing alone. It was always in conjunction to what he was saying and as to what he was teaching. Now, I know today it's sad that there's a lot of preachers and teachers that just love telling stories. I like to call them skyscraper sermons, where it's one story built upon another, and that's literally what they are. You don't even know what they're teaching. They just, oh, and we walk away saying, "Oh, I love that story." You don't love the Bible, but you love the story, you know. And so that's rather tragic. But Jesus never did that. He wasn't into entertaining. He would use a parable to grab the listeners, to draw them in, to cause them to see themselves, to see God, and then make a change is why he gave parables. So he says here that the land of a certain rich man was very productive. Now, how did this man make such a living? How did this man become so wealthy? Well, he made it by honest hard work. Surely when you talk about a farmer, you're talking about someone that's not lazy. You're talking about someone that works and does what needs to be done in order to ultimately lead to a harvest. And you look at our nation in a sense is the breadbasket of the world. And it's been built by just strong men and women that were farmers, that tilled the soil, planted the seeds, fought against adversities and various, you know, weather conditions, all of this stuff in order to have a crop, in order to be that breadbasket. So it is a hard job being a farmer, but you know what? That is a great, great profession or a job to have. It truly is. You talk about someone that has a great profession, it's that of farming. Hard, hard work. Now, as we look at this, let's keep in mind that this is talking about a farmer, but we could even say there was a man that went to college, and this man, as he went to college, decided to get into medical, to become a doctor. So he went into his medical school, and then he did his residency, and then he decided to branch off into a particular specialty as a doctor. And so it could even be something like that, or a person that was an entrepreneur, and you know they had a truck, and then they got two trucks, and they got three trucks, and then they hired a dispatcher, and then eventually they literally formed a trucking company. It could be that way. It could be a person that comes up with an invention, and he patents it, and he starts selling it on the internet. Pretty soon, it just grabs. Everybody's got to have it, and it's like the guy that came up with a pet rock, which I never understood, a pet rock. And so they come up with this thing. They start selling them. People are buying them. And so pretty soon, this thing becomes this major operations like MyPillow. Oh, God, those commercials, MyPillow. For a while, I wouldn't even buy it because I hated the commercials so much. And then one was given to me, and I love that pillow. I can't believe I said that, but I hope they take that from the message. But that, I actually like it. So, but you know, you see a guy that like him, Lindell, that just came up through the ranks. He was born again, and God blessed him. And of course, the woke culture doesn't like him because he's conservative. He loves God. They don't want to hear that. So they want to X them out. So he can even be like, we can even put MyPillow in here, and the MyPillow guy in here. You know, it's like a guy that has this incredible business that does everything, you know, makes everything. So here's a person that has made their money through honest means. You know, God never, ever praises wastefulness. God never, ever commends laziness. Never at all. So verse 17 says, and he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? So what does this man do? This man looks at all the blessings that he has received, and what does he think of? He thinks of himself. He never once mentions God in here at all. He never once has a heart of gratitude and thankfulness. He doesn't even look at it as a blessing. He looks at everything he has, and he just is like, bless me. You know, it's like, look what I did. Look what I did. He never once thinks of God. So this man was selfish. When we read this parable, there are 11 personal pronouns. This guy has an eye problem that no ophthalmologist can fix. I mean, he's just I. I mean, he is just into himself. I do, my crops, my barn, my grain, my goods. And in the whole process, this man fails to see he's simply a steward of God. It all belongs to God. It isn't his. He's not the master. He's the servant. God's the master. And he just doesn't see it. Now, today we would say, I need to take care of number one. But God does not ascribe to that philosophy. That's not a biblical philosophy. I need to look out for number one. That's not in the Bible. This man had that thought, and that was his perspective, but that was not God's at all. And I love what David does in 2 Samuel 7:18. One day, David looks over his kingdom, looks over everything that's happened in 2 Samuel 7:18. Listen to what David says. Then David the king went in and sat before the Lord, and he said, "Who am I, O Lord God? What is my house that you have brought me this far? Man, you have blessed me. Why did you even think about me? Why am I a recipient of your blessings? I am just like humble." He was humbled by it. Again, material blessings of life are either a mirror that we see ourselves or a window in which we see God. When we look at the blessings of our lives, are we seeing self in a mirror? Are we saying, "Look what I did, look what I did"? Or is it really a window in which we see the Lord and we say, "Wow, God, look what you did. You have so blessed me. You have so abundantly blessed my life. You have been so good to me. You've been so gracious to me. But here is a man that all he sees is a mirror. He sees his ugly face in it, and he's just so taken back by how good he is, how smart he is, all the things that he's done through his own strength and through his own works. One said it this way: it's easier to face the battles of life than to accept the blessings. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? I think one of the hardest things to handle is when God begins to bless our lives, and we start to think it's us. We start to think, "Look what I did. Look what I did. Look what I did. Look who I am." It's cute when our kids are small. When our kids were small, and we had a swimming pool. You know, it was a big pit that you came by and put money in. It was a swimming pool, you know. People that like swimming pools haven't owned one. So, you know, it was a thing where they would jump off the diamond. "Look at me, look at me, look at me." Well, it's so cute. But when they're 40, look at me, no, it's, no. The only thing cute is if you belly flop. That's the only thing cute. So, "Look at me, look at me." That's what he was doing. Every time this thing is a mirror. I'm just seeing my ugly mug. That's what I'm saying. Is it me? This is ultimately what happened. Turn over to Deuteronomy 6:10. I want you to see this. Deuteronomy 6:10. This was a warning that was given by Moses to the new generation that was going to cross over and into the land of Canaan. And this is an interesting warning that he gives to them. And it's a warning about, you better watch out. God's going to bless you, and you better be careful. You better be very, very careful at the blessings of God. Deuteronomy 6:10, he says, "Then it shall come about that when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied, then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery." You better watch it. You better be very careful. There's that quote from a number of years ago when President Obama said, "You didn't build it." Of course, he's referring to the fact that all the blessings of life were the result of government. They're not. Some of the biggest problems of our lives is the result of government. It's not the solution. And he took a lot of flack for that statement, rightfully so, rightfully so. Some have said, "Well, that isn't what he meant." No, we heard what he said. We know what he meant. I don't need the news media to tell me what I heard. I know what I heard. And so, again, we didn't build it. God did. This is what God did. And he says, you better watch it. You better be very, very careful that you don't start looking at your property. You start looking at the houses. You start looking at the orchards. And you go, "Look what I built. Look what I got." Again, when we look at the blessings of life, do we find ourselves inflating our egos, or do we find ourselves being humbled by all that God has done for us? Great question. Look at verse 18. Then he said, this is what I will do. So here's this man speaking to himself, not speaking to God, not praying, but speaking to himself. The man was materialistic, no doubt about it. I will tear down my barns and I will build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. Now, we can't find fault for him wanting to preserve what he had and to be able to put it away. There's nothing wrong with looking to the future and thinking, you know what, I better put money aside, I better plan for this. That's Bible talks about that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that at all. But look at verse 19, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. You see, these are the words of a starved soul that after getting all that he has, it's still not quite enough. What we see here is a man that is hedonistic. He's into hedonism. You know, hedonism teaches that the sum total of man's life is pleasure. That's hedonism. That man is created for pleasure. Man, whatever feels good, whatever a man wants to do, that's why I'm living. That's why I'm breathing. All of life is about pleasure. So he says to his soul, he's conversing with his own soul here, which is weird. He says, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Here's this little finite guy thinking, oh, I got a lot of years ahead of me. I got a lot of fun and pleasure ahead of me. And this little finite individual is saying all this. By the way, this is the only place in the Bible that retirement is spoken about. It's not real good either. And let me tell you why. It's because there's nothing wrong with retirement. But if you are contemplating retirement and you're not including God, you're a fool. You really are. You really are. And if you're offended by that, it's because you're a fool. That's why you're offended. Pretty basic, huh? Because if you're not a fool, why would you be offended, right? So that's why. So there's nothing wrong with retirement. But if all of your planning, you don't plan on giving to God and you don't plan on living for the Lord, you're blowing it. You are absolutely blowing it. You're no different from this loon that we're looking at right here. I mean, really, there's no difference at all. Jesus said in Matthew 6:27, and who of you by being worried can add a single hour to his life? And through all of the sacrificing and all of the decisions, you can't change a thing. You're just a finite being. You're a servant, not a master. You think of Abraham. You know, Abraham was the father of faith. He was a man of faith. But boy, he had some times where he backslid. But one thing about Abraham, he always returned and put his faith in God. He was a very wealthy man too. Abraham was wealthy, but he entrusted it to the Lord. You look at Lot. What a contrast to his nephew Lot, who looked towards Sodom, moved towards Sodom, was living in Sodom, was found at the gates of Sodom. City councilman, city of Sodom. And he lost it all. So this man says, I'm going to take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. What a self-centered individual. Nothing's wrong with enjoyment. Listen to this, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17. Listen to these words. There's nothing wrong with enjoying what God has blessed you with. Listen. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasures of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Here's a simple test right here. See, for instance, right now, father's husband, you get a new position, you get a new raise, and now you got a chunk of money coming in. How do you respond to that blessing? Do you say, all right, I'm going to bless my family. I'm going to take them on a special vacation, or I'm going to do this. I'm going to purchase this. I'm going to do this for them. It's because you're thinking in those ways of blessing others with what God's blessing. Or do you say, you know, I got two Harleys. A third Harley would be a lot better, you know. That's what I really need. I'll just buy more chrome. It doesn't have to be new. I'll just chrome it out, you know, or something like that. I'll become a chromosexual or something like that. I'll get into chrome, you know. That wasn't even in my notes. I don't know where that came from. But again, what is our thinking here? What are we thinking? It's like, we got this blessing now. Where is it going? Well, look what Jesus says again in verse 15. Go back to verse 15. Notice what he says. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. So what could the farmer do? Well, I'm going to suggest some things the farmer could have done. We could change this whole story. Let me tell you how you change the story. Number one, he could have called all of his friends in and had a fellowship of thanksgiving. He could have called all of his friends in and said, come over to my house. I'm footing the bill. You know, we're all going to eat. And I want to tell you what God's done for me. I am going to have a praise fest. I'm going to tell you what the Lord has done for me. He could have done that. It could have changed everything. It really would have changed this whole story and how it ends and everything else. Secondly, he could have invested in the kingdom. He could have said, you know what? I realize I'm not going to be here forever. And so I think I'm going to start investing and give to the temple, give to the synagogue, and I'm just going to give so I can stockpile dividends in heaven for the future. Number third, he could have sought out those that were less fortunate. He could have said, well, I got this neighbor down here, and the husband just had an accident, and a cart ran over him, and so he can't work. So I think I'll help them out and help them through this time. And number four, he could have given some of his wealth to members of his family. Maybe there were members of the family that were less fortunate. You know, you have a family member that's putting their kid through, you know, University of Jerusalem or something. I don't know. They say, I'm going to give towards the college fund, you know. Or number five, he could have invested his money in the community. Because I live in this community. I'm part of this community. So I'm going to invest in the community. It would have changed everything. But we need to look at life in the way of an investment. And that's what it is. We need to invest. Invest in that which is eternal or that which is temporal. It's an investment. Luke 12:33, sell your possessions, give to charity, make yourselves purses which do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes near nor moth destroys. I like what Jim Elliot once said. He was martyred for sharing the gospel. He says, he is no fool to give what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. That would have been the wise thing to do. Look at verse 20. But God said to him, you fool. He is a fool, not a success. Now, those in the world right now would disagree with what I'm saying. They say, Jesus is way off. He's off base. He's missing it. No, God says that he's a fool, not a success. Why? Because he left God out. He thought that his possessions would bring him peace, and they won't, and they can't. Now, what is a fool? A fool is a person that lives life and makes decisions as if God doesn't exist. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So a fool lives their life, never consults God, never even acts as if God exists, and they just simply live their life without God. Again, Warren Wiersbe says, when little men cast long shadows, it's a sign that the sun's beginning to set. And that's what we have here. He's a little man, and the sun's beginning to set. Again, verse 19 says, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. This is a false peace based upon things. Things are temporal. Things don't last. The man was a servant, not a master. He's not in control. Look what it says. This very night, your soul is required of you. Wow, what an investment. You know, this is one appointment that every one of us will keep. You know, there's some appointments. You got doctor's appointments. You got different things. You can keep canceling them and canceling them and canceling them. But you know that this is one appointment you can't cancel? This is an appointment set by God in which we will stand before God. God gave us things to use and people to love. If we start loving things, we'll start using people. That's what we'll do. We'll reverse it. Ecclesiastes 5:12 says, "The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep." It doesn't satisfy. It can't satisfy. It never was intended to satisfy. The man was a pauper, not a rich man. Notice, now who will own what you have prepared? There it is. So now this man that was so wealthy is now a pauper, and now it's all being turned over to someone else. How are they going to do? What will they do with it? Will they squander it? Will they invest it? Will they be lazy? What will they do with what they received? This brings us now to the supposition, the conclusion now in verse 21. Notice how Jesus ends this. So is the man. Or he is a fool. So is the fool that has invested in the wrong account. So is the fool that invests in the world but doesn't invest in the Lord. So is the fool that reasons in his own self but doesn't pray and allow God to direct his steps. Who lays up treasure for himself. He looks at the blessings as coming from himself, not from the hand of God, and is not rich towards God. He's not rich towards a gracious God that has blessed him. I'm going to close this morning with three applications, three things that we just talked about that I want to conclude with this morning. Number one, the material blessings of life are either a mirror that we see ourselves or a window by which we see God. Number two, people think that an abundance of things is the key to a successful life. Jesus teaches the opposite in the parable, that an abundance of things can make you a failure, not a success. It's the opposite. And thirdly, when we look at the blessings of life, do we find ourselves inflating our egos, or do we find ourselves being humbled by all that God has done for us? Are you humbled this morning by what God has done? Or are you just patting yourself on the back saying, "Blessed be me"? Is it a mirror or is it a window? Which one is it?